Hey everybody, I'm your four-eyed professor, Chris Levens, and I'm super excited to talk to you today. Our roll call is for new and experienced ODs, optometry students, and even those just interested in this profession. We'll cover a number of topics together, and I'll help you see them through a professor's eyes. Please take your seats. School's in session. Welcome back, everybody. Thanks for tuning in. We're actually covering a topic today that we've not touched on yet, and that is myopia control. So I'm excited to welcome a guest to the podcast, Dr. Dwight Barnes. Hey, Dwight, thanks for joining us.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me.
Hey, my pleasure. So before we even get started, please tell everybody a bit about you and your practice and optometry and some things that people just don't know.
Sure. Well, first of all, I was excited to hear you say that you hadn't touched on myopia control on this podcast before, because it's by far my favorite subject within optometry. I think that even though it's got a lot more buzz and coverage over the last 3 to 4 years, I think we're scratching the surface and it doesn't get the attention that it deserves. There's a lot of important topics in eye care, of course. But to give a little background on kind of me and where we got started, so I graduated SCO, as where you're affiliated with there, and I married a classmate. My wife, Dr. Kelly Barnes, we got married, we did residencies, we were up in the Boston area, and we knew we wanted to relocate back to North Carolina, which is where I'm from, and my wife Kelly is very fond of North Carolina as well. And so initially what we wanted to do was find two separate practices, just out of the thought that maybe forge our own identity a little bit. I don't know if professional codependence is a thing, but you know, forge our own identity. So we looked for independent practices, which we were both interested in, that were close enough together that we could commute our own ways and not drive too far. And we were fortunate to find that. And we worked in those practices for 4 or 5 years. And then back in 2008, we decided it was about time to open our own practice. And trying to look where we might want to live as a nice place, you know, live close to where you work, short commute and all that fun stuff. We settled in Cary, North Carolina. So for those of you who don't know that, it's outside of Raleigh. It's just barely west of Raleigh, and it's, you know, quiet. It's suburbia. It's a nice place to raise kids and all of that. So we opened our practice, and the location's been good to us. We've had kind of steady growth throughout, and we've done an expansion and looking to do another expansion. And at the time, all we were doing was just, we wanted to provide general routine eye care at a really high level, like a lot of people who get inspired to do when they get in on practice. And myopia management was kind of the furthest thing from my mind. I had nothing against it. It's just, that was before it really took off. I didn't know a ton about it. And, you know, like everyone else, I would see the standard things in my practice. The young patient comes in who we saw the year before, and they're worse by 3/4 of a doctor or whatever it ends up being. And the questions from parents, isn't there something we can do about this? And not having great answers. And that doesn't feel great when you're sitting in the exam room and they're looking at you as the expert and saying, all right, well, you fixed my husband's eye infection and you got me seeing better with some bifocal contacts. And why can't you fix this? Because it's a common problem and it's a big problem. And that lack of satisfying answers didn't feel good. So I reached out to some colleagues who were a little ahead of me on the myopia management curve and had been doing that for a while, and set up time with them and said, hey, I just want to learn more about this. And from what I understand, talking to other colleagues, I don't think this is that uncommon. The bug got me, you know, I really got the bug in a big way. And when I started doing a few cases, I just loved it. I loved it from a challenge aspect, right? There are unique challenges to that, just like there are for fitting scleral lenses or treating dry eye or what have you. But I loved the challenge of it. I loved gradually over time taking on more complex and difficult cases and seeing that I could handle those cases and have good outcomes. And I really love the appreciation of the parents. I think that's what really resonated with me is those parents who have gotten answers that they didn't love. And then they have somebody say, yeah, we do have some options. Let's do this. And gradually over time, we get more sophisticated on it, right? It goes from this looks like it's going to help to, hey, this is really helping. Here's axial length. Here's how we're measuring it. This is how you stack up to last year. And all those things that allow us to give them a more complete picture of what this problem is of myopia, why it matters as much of it as it does, and how the strategies that we're using are being very successful for them.
Fantastic story. I can tell you're excited about it. I can totally get why it's a challenge. Let's talk about some of the background.
Yeah.
Because myopia control, at least in its current, in its current title and what it encompasses, is still relatively new. And it's certainly, I agree with you, is a very hot topic in eye care. To the top of my mind, I think of, well, we can employ myopia control via pharmaceutical, via a soft contact lens, via Ortho-K. Did I hit them all, or am I leaving some out?
Those are the big three. You know, if you, we certainly over time try to hit the environmental factors. Not that they're going to be enough by themselves. They're not. And you know, it's, who's going to not ever be on electronics in this day and age, right? But right. Parents are interested and we try to touch them. But if you talk like things that we would actually charge a fee for instead of just give a piece of advice, and yeah, those would be the big three: Ortho-K, the soft dual focus lenses, and atropine, and maybe some combinations of them. And until such time in the near future when we get some myopia control glasses in this country.
Right. So then, for your practice and your experience thus far, which of those have you employed, and how do you, and if you employ more than one, how do you decide which ones, which treatment of choice might be appropriate for the patient that you're seeing at that moment?
Yeah. So I do a lot more Ortho-K than I do anything else. A, because it's fun. B, because there is such a wow factor. You know, they come in, and if you're treating somebody who's less than like a -3, and they're going to come in one day one, and they're going to see pretty well on the chart in most cases if everything went well. And that wow factor is cool for the patient and for me, you know? And I think the other reason is parents feel good about the idea that the lens that they're wearing, or in our case, when we're shaping the cornea, we call them reshaping molds. And that's just to try to get away from the commodity that is a soft contact lens. I think it really resonates well with them, with these young kids that are 7, 8, 9, 10 years old, that the lens wear and lens care is taking place at home under the supervision of the parents.
Sure.
Now, the soft lenses in most cases are daily disposables, like a MiSight or a Natural View multifocal. They don't have a lot of care involved, but especially the younger kids, I think parents really do like that. I think they also really like the ease of it, right? If the child's struggling a little bit with handling them early on, the parent can get involved and not have to worry about, oh gosh, they need to take it out at school and they're struggling and they don't have another lens, and all those little things there. But I think the biggest reason is Ortho-K. We were doing that before MiSight came out. We were doing that before Natural View multifocal came out. And we had enough success, fortunately for us, that I kind of became known as the Ortho-K guy in the area. And so patients come in looking for Ortho-K. In some cases, I find myself saying, all right, that's great. I could probably do Ortho-K, but your child is maybe a better candidate for a MiSight or something like that. And in some cases, I think they are. In some cases, I think that's just a much more straightforward treatment. I get a kid coming in wearing a soft daily disposable sphere contact. Why have them get used to doing Ortho-K mold? That's easy. Just switch them over, and very little clinic time, very little effort on their part. So we do employ all three. Some of the examples when we would use atropine would be if a patient's got a prescription that's going to be very, very challenging for Ortho-K, and we can treat way more patients than we used to, but let's say they've got a big mismatch in their corneal cylinder and the refractive cylinder. That takes more effort. It's not impossible, but it takes a lot more effort. They've got an awful lot of astigmatism, and let's say maybe a low amount of spherical component. And so they've got a cylindrical component that's significantly higher than the spherical component. And maybe there is a fair bit of against the rule, and all those things make it more challenging. There are toric dual focus, you got to do a custom lens in that case. That's somebody who might do, but that's somebody who could do very well with atropine. You know, they wear glasses, they like glasses, they're not super motivated to get out of glasses. Sometimes the fees that we would charge for Ortho-K in that case would be significant enough that maybe it's just easier for them to do atropine instead of having that higher, you know, you have to charge for your time, and we would have to charge a higher tier for that. Another example is if a kid's just really, really young and his parents aren't comfortable having them in any kind of contact lens. I mean, we'll treat young kids. Some parents are cool with it. Other parents will, you know, say, hey, my kid's pretty young. They're 5, 6 years old, and we're not really into that. Well, fine. Let's tread water with atropine. Mm-hmm. We may get great control. It may be something a little less than what we get with orthokeratology, but we're doing something. And that's right. Always my advice to them is, well, if you're going to take a year to decide what's best for in the long term, that's fine. But in the meantime, let's do something. Let's put the brakes on to the extent that we can. Instead of waiting, when the younger they are, the faster they tend to progress. Now's the time to do it. And just waiting for a year, it's okay. It's just not an ideal solution there. So, sure. So that's usually who we use atropine on. And we will occasion combine it with an ortho-K or something like that. The great soft lens patients, like I mentioned, I think I'll kind of jump the gun on the soft lens, but you get a spherical contact lens patient and they're wearing a soft lens and they're happy. Mm-hmm. The parent in many cases is motivated by myopia control and the child is just, I want to put in my lenses and I want to see well. So keeping it as easy as possible on the child is going to get their buy-in. And so it makes the process easier. So that's a great candidate for them. If they're a really low myope, let's say they're like a 0.75, but they're still symptomatic for blur, they want to see better. You have to make some modifications on an ortho-K design to get great myopia control at that low level. It's not impossible, but you have to design it specifically to do that. Whereas, you know, a MySight lens theoretically should work about as good on a minus 0.75 as it should on a minus 5 1/4. So sometimes those are patients that would be good. Another example for soft lenses real quick is if they have moderate corneal astigmatism and no refractive cylinder, right?
Okay.
You got to work at not inducing cylinder. So just throw them in a soft lens and they're happy.
So let's talk about some of the science now. And here's where some of the challenges lie when a practitioner is trying to consider, should I, you know, enter this category of myopia control or mm-hmm. not? Well, let's look at the data. Well, the data can be confounding. Admittedly, whenever you're looking at research in a population study,
sure.
The population study may say, well, it works or it doesn't work. Yep. But when you try to adapt that to a singular patient, well, even though the population study worked, it may not work for that individual. Even though the population work, well, it still may work for that individual. And so, you know, we have to remember that a patient is a solo person, whereas these big landmark studies are, you know, are hundreds oftentimes of patients, yep. if not more. Well, when it comes to myopia, you mentioned we might be examining a child 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10-ish. Well, we may not know everything that we did, whether it did anything for a generation or two. And within that patient, there's no control. So we don't know, well, here's exactly where the patient would have ended up, but here's what we did. So it's confounding as a treatment strategy because we go to a lot of effort and then don't know really what to predict and aren't going to know for some time what the impact is.
Sure. Those are valid. And I think it becomes an issue occasionally when you have a parent that's more skeptical of it, because we have two different types of parents who come in. We have parents who come in who either A, already know about myopia control, and that's why they sought us out in the first place.
Right.
Or B, as soon as we mention it, they say, yes, that's what I've been looking for. Does this really exist? Fantastic. How do I get signed up? Then there's the skeptical parent who we never want to engage them with fear mongering or be, you know, overly persuasive or pushy or anything like that. But if we think it's in the best interest of their child, we do want to present it as what's in the best interest of their child. And those are the ones that are going to care a lot about those studies. It's a really valid point. And it sounds, your comment sounds similar to some of what I say to parents, because they'll say, how much does it work? How much does it slow it down? And I give them averages, right? And I remind them, I think it takes that reminding them when they come in periodically, because Even in the studies that show the most benefit from myopia control, they don't show a complete stopping of myopia progression. Right. They show a significant slowing of myopia progression. We get patients that don't progress at all. Those are big high fives all around the room if we see them after 6 years and say, oh my gosh, we stopped it altogether. That's fantastic. And then we see patients that progress, and it's a matter of saying, okay, did we slow it significantly? How do we know? And we don't completely. So I will, I choose my words carefully. I use slow progression, not stop progression. And the best piece of information I think that we have on a visit-to-visit basis, whether it's been 4 months or whether it's been 6 months or what have you, is trying to look at the axial length. And we have general ideas of how much growth at a given age is appropriate and how much growth is more than that. And so if we can keep them somewhere around what we would expect at their age or less, and sometimes it's less, then we can feel pretty good about what we're doing. And if we don't, we can talk about, is there something we can do to help? Maybe it's adding atropine to an ortho-K patient. Maybe it's changing our ortho-K design to build up a little bit of a deeper reverse curve, a little bit more of that red ring on topography, and induce a bit more of that peripheral defocus that can help. And sometimes there's a patient who just doesn't respond well at all. And it's frustrating, and you do your best and you try. So we don't see a whole lot of those, but the literature does show that there are patients who don't respond fantastic to it.
At what age do you cease the treatment and go to a more traditional eye care treatment, of meaning refractive treatment like spectacles or traditional contact lenses?
I think that depends a lot as to whether they're in ortho-K versus one of the other modalities, because ortho-K, as you know, is a great treatment for adults as well. I don't treat nearly as many adults just because I'm a myopia control guy. Right. I am happy to fit them. And when I do, it's usually because their child came in to see me and they said, hey, can I do that too? But I have plenty of patients who keep going through college and grad school and job and wear them as their permanent vision correction. And I have other patients who say, no, when we think we've lost that benefit of myopia management, I'd rather wear a regular soft contact, or I'd rather wear glasses or what have you. So for atropine, we tend to stop that earlier. The atropine, I don't think, has nearly as much benefit once you're getting past 16, 17 years old. I do continue it longer if a parent is concerned and if the patient is having no significant side effects and they want to. You know, and I'll have that conversation. You know, it's gradually diminishing returns. We do not know exactly what age your child would stop getting more nearsighted. It could stop at around 17, 16 years old. It could stop at around 24, 25 years old. And somewhere, and I think we tend to make that decision around the time they're going off to college, because that's a big life change. And maybe they just keep it as simple as possible for them. If they are in ortho-K, sometimes we stop around that age, because I find that around the time they go to college, their sleep schedule gets a little messed up for a lot of kids. And if they have a low prescription, it doesn't matter. If they have a difficult prescription, sometimes they do have trouble getting enough sleep, and we'll say, okay, we rode this as long as we need to. They probably don't need this from a myopia control standpoint. And if the vision's not perfect, then let's go to a different modality. So ortho-K, they don't ever have to stop it, and I present it that way.
So let's talk a little bit about atropine, because this month, hot off the press, JAMA published two articles, of which I know we know a lot of people in both study groups. One came from the CHAMP study group. One came from the PEDIG study group. And, you know, potentially part of the difference in the results could be the methodology of the analysis.
Yep.
But, you know, for the most part, globally speaking, PEDIG said 0.1% atropine wasn't effective, and CHAMP said that it was. So we basically have an equivocal result. And that then throws us another curveball as practitioners, saying, okay, I get that as a population study, but wait, how do I alter my practice now based on more confusion?
Yeah, and I think the answer whatever answer we come up with today is going to be evolving over the next 6 to 12 months. Because of what's being done currently with studies and with new products coming out. You know, Viluma's coming out with a non-compounded version of atropine, and they're doing their own studies there. So you're going to be able to send an atropine prescription to CVS or Walgreens or wherever a patient uses, instead of using a compounding pharmacy. So it makes things easier if it's effective for the patient. There was actually a group discussion that I had at a meeting within the last couple of years related to this, because you're right, the study methodology can affect it. The other thing that I think gets overlooked in some cases is there is not simply one way that is always followed to compound atropine, to compound medications in general. You know, you can dilute it using saline, you can reconstruct from a powder. I mean, there are a few different ways to do it. And assuming that the results of those are completely the same is probably a big assumption. And the thing that really made me realize that is if you look at two of the studies that have been used very frequently, the Adam study and the LAMP study, they had very, very different levels of benefit of 0.01 atropine. They weren't that close. The Adam study was showing that it was somewhat effective, and the LAMP study was showing that it wasn't. And that's when we kind of started moving toward the higher concentrations, 0.025 and 0.05. As of right this minute, I follow that study pretty closely, and it's rare that I prescribe 0.01 in any young patient who I think is at a high risk of progressing. If they're an older child, maybe that would be appropriate. If we just don't think they're likely to progress as fast, but 0.05 seems to be pretty effective on a lot of patients. I do find more variability in the effectiveness in my own clinic than I do with Ortho-K, but that's what we have to go on.
Sure.
Now, I'm very interested to see what happens when that drop is freely available on the market, because, you know, if they're showing benefit for that with a lower concentration, then clinically you want to use the lowest concentration of any medication that's likely to be very effective for them. But right now, I think we have to base it on the studies that we have readily available. So I don't find 0.01 to generally be very therapeutically effective for most children. So we don't tend to use that very much.
Yeah. How much consideration do you take of the parents' prescriptions into projecting you might think would be in store for an untreated child?
Yeah, you know, it's hard to plot that out in terms of, hey, I think this child's going to end up as a 5.5 or as a 6 or what have you. But we absolutely have that in our patient history. So when they come in, whether they saw us for a comprehensive exam and we scheduled a myopia management evaluation, or whether they were referred to us for that, we'll go through, we look over the records that we've received, we check a baseline axial length. If we think that Ortho-K might be in the cards, we'll get some baseline topographies. And then we want to find out, okay, how long have they been wearing glasses, or when were they diagnosed as myopia? It's great if we have a history of their rate of progression. And of course, if they're from our own clinic, we have that. We ask, are either of the parents myopic? Certainly a myopic parent, we've known this for a while, increases risk. Two myopic parents increases it more. And if they are highly myopic, that increases it a lot more. And that all goes into the history there. So one of the pieces of equipment we use, and there's a lot of great pieces of equipment for axial length, but we use the Myopia Master. And I think there's similar benefits to the Maya and some of the other ones out there. We can put all that in there. And so we're putting in, you know, number of nearsighted parents, how much time they're spending at near work, how much time they spend per week outdoors. And then we take all that and we put a low, moderate, or high assessment on their risk. And there's a report that we can print out that has that along with their current axial length plotted on a graph for like you'd have a height weight chart at the pediatrician. And we can show them that. And we are way less concerned for the patient with maybe one very low myopic parent. They're only in the 40th percentile for axial length, and they have a low prescription themselves, versus somebody who's at the 85th percentile or higher. And we see people who are basically off the chart for axial length, and they've got a parent who's like I was, like a minus 1250. So that's not a great recipe for future prognosis for that child.
So let's take you out of the doctor coat for a moment. Yeah. And you become the parent.
Sure.
And I'm just playing devil's advocate here. So you're a minus 12.5. Let's say Kelly's a minus 12.5 too. Mm-hmm. You're highly educated adults. You know the impact of being minus 12.5, as well as the health risks, ocular health risks of being minus 12.5. And you say, all right, so for my our 7-year-old, you know, we've read a little bit about this. We don't want them to be at risk as well as have the visual challenges that we've gone through. So we're going to roll in with Doc and whatever you recommend. And so now we go through a course of treatment. Your child's very compliant. Mm-hmm. And now 10 years later, your child is minus 11.5. Mm-hmm. And now we're having a discussion. Okay, yeah, I get mathematically it potentially had a reduction, but really, did we do anything?
That's a tough one because, you know, if we look back just through our own clinical careers outside of myopia management, you know, we see kids who had two nearsighted parents who ended up at about the same level. Mm-hmm. We have kids who ended up less on their own. We didn't do anything. They ended up, you know, the kid, the parents are a 10 and the kids a 4. And we had kids that were, that ended up substantially higher than either of their parents. I think it's just one of those things where we have to understand, to your point you made earlier, that is a sample size of one. It's absolutely impossible to have a control. Even if they have siblings, right? Their siblings have different risk factors and might end up differently. And I think the parent just has to understand that we're reducing risk.
Yeah.
You know, it's their likelihood of getting worse is lower. The rate at which they get worse is, based on all the studies that we have, likely to be reduced by a substantial degree. And in most cases, we think it will be. And we can't tell them how nearsighted their child is ultimately going to get. And and I've had kids where at the very end, you know, we've been doing this for a while now. I say, well, yeah, I think we helped that kid, but maybe not as much as typical. Yeah. And then I've had the kids that pleasantly surprised. And I say surprised kind of maybe before about the year 2000, which was when we started really tracking axial length, where they decide to stop wearing OrthoK and we're washing them out, prescribing glasses or soft contacts. And I'm kind of mentally crossing my fingers saying, man, I really hope they didn't get very much worse. I don't think they did. And I'm like, hey, all right. It was only a quarter diopter over like 5 years. That's fantastic. Those parents are going to be excited. So.
Yeah. Well, and then that brings up another question. So when you cease the treatment, do you ever see some rebound effect that happens a lot quicker than you would anticipate a natural change?
I have not seen a rebound effect, at least in patients who do continue it through the majority of adolescence, you know, as they're getting to the end of high school. I have not seen a rebound effect. Yeah. And that's including atropine.
Yeah.
You know, they've shown that with higher dosages, there is a rebound effect with 0.05, but it's fairly insignificant for most patients. Mm-hmm. And if they're lower than that, that shouldn't be a concern. And with OrthoK and soft dual focus lenses, I haven't really seen a rebound effect.
Well, then, you know, we've really covered this pretty well. That the last thing that I'm really curious about is, I'm the parent.
Yep.
Dwight, talk to me. I don't know anything about this. My child, you've been taken care of for a while. Their myopia is getting a little bit worse. How do you bring up this conversation to me, and how do you identify my child might be a good candidate?
Sure. The first thing is, if we have seen them in our clinic for a little while, and so we know that history, and so maybe they don't have a high prescription yet, but it is clearly increasing. They went from a 0.5 to a 1.25 to a 2.25, let's say. It's still not terribly high, but they're young. I try to let my own enthusiasm for the benefits of this come through. I get excited about it. The parents can see that. And so I get concerned for my patients, just like all good doctors get concerned for their patients. And I express that. I say, hey, look, I want to share with you where the prescription has been at. This is now the third visit. There is a trend here that concerns me, and I want to explain why. So we went from this prescription to this prescription to this prescription. That is unfortunately not surprising. As parents and as clinicians, we can be frustrated by that, but we don't have any right to be surprised by that, because now we know that that's common. And then if they came from outside, or maybe it's the first time I've seen them and they don't wear glasses, we don't use the trend, but I share the same thing. At your child's age, kids who are nearsighted get more nearsighted. That's what they do. They do it like it's their job. They don't all do it at the same rate. I can't tell you how nearsighted your child will be in a year, but we know that we fully expect that to get worse. What you may not know is that now we have some treatments that can slow that process down and try to keep that at a lower level. And then the next thing I always hit is why? Because number one, the end result isn't so they won't have thick glasses. It's a nice side effect. It's wonderful that we can keep them less dependent on glasses. Glasses look better with thinner lenses, right? You're less dependent on if you lose one or break one. And a lot of times parents will look at it as, well, I have LASIK. I'm just going to get on LASIK when they're 22 years old or whatever, and problem solved. So I'll explain to them the medical side, right? And I think taking the eye length is a helpful way to do that, because it's not just simply a number on a prescription pad. I tell them that as your child gets more nearsighted, their eye grows longer front to back. Now, children's eyes are going to grow anyway because they're getting taller and their arms and legs are getting longer. Their eye is going to grow longer. But when you're getting more nearsighted, your eye grows longer faster than it should. As that eye grows longer at that rate, the retina stretches thinner.
Right.
And that thinner retina has health concerns, such as a higher risk of retinal tears, holes, detachment. It also increases risk of certain types of glaucoma and risk of vision loss over time. I don't want that for your child. And so I would advise you to strongly consider some of these efforts that we can use to try to slow that down. And we put together a pretty informative brochure a few years ago that goes over, why do we care? What can we do about it? It has some of the environmental things too, because if they do nothing else, at least they can try to increase their time spent outside and to whatever extent that helps, and keep those things in mind. And then the biggest piece is parents get really, really busy. I know from being a parent, and you know, you fully mean to do this thing and it never happens, right? So then follow-up is important. So we have a myopia control coordinator on our staff who coordinates those programs, and I can't spend 45 minutes educating them in the exam room because I fortunately have other patients coming through the door. So I'll have the brief version of the explanation. I'll give them the myopia management brochure, and I will hand them off to Kristen, who's our myopia coordinator, and say, hey, let me have her finish this conversation. If you'd like to schedule an evaluation, we'll bring you in for that. If you're not sure, we'll have her follow up in a week or so. And that way that gives them a chance to read over it, think about it, get another email or a call from us. If it slipped off the radar, it's back on the radar. And then ultimately they'll decide if that's something they're interested in or not.
Yeah, I like it. I think those are great discussion points, and you really have your processes down.
Yeah.
Dwight, you've shared with us wealth of information as like we started with a topic that we haven't discussed yet. And so I'm delighted for the audience to really hear this from someone as successful as well as so excited about this treatment modality. As we start to close out, is there any other words of wisdom you might impart to people even thinking about getting their toes wet with this?
Yeah, I've got a few things. Number one, you do not have to do Ortho-K to do myopia control. In my opinion, it's the most fun way to do it, but you do not have to do Ortho-K. You can fit the soft dual focus lenses. They're not significantly harder to fit than a regular soft contact lens. You do not have to measure axial length to do myopia management. If you get serious about it, you're going to want to measure that. It makes the process more scientific, but you do not have to measure that. And please don't let that hold you back from doing it. It's a matter of just putting your systems in place to effectively educate parents. And the second thing I will say is, if you are someone who has just barely gotten started and you feel like you have a lot to learn, or you're somebody who has not even gotten started and you really feel like you want to gain information on this as quickly as you can, there are a few different places that you can get good information. Your lens manufacturers can help you wherever you order your rigid Gasperm lenses. When you go through the certification process, they can help you. But if I had to point to one thing, the American Academy of Ortho-K and Myopia Control has a meeting every year called Vision by Design. Okay. And that is it's a 3-day meeting, similar to a lot of the big meetings that are out there, but is fully focused on myopia control and Ortho-K. And they have a boot camp program. And so when you're coming in, they send you through this boot camp program, and it's COPE approved. You get your CE credits while you're at it. And it tells you all the things about why it matters, how to measure and assess axial length, how to determine a fee structure, how to set up your contracts for parents to sign for informed consent. All the things you need to know to fit these and be successful with them. And so you probably get the equivalent of a couple of years worth of experience in the course of a couple of days. And I think that's a great place to start.
I love it. Fantastic. Great advice, Dwight. I'm sure the audience appreciates everything that you shared with us today. At some point, I'd love to have you on again in the future, but our thanks to you for sharing some of your personal time with this really interesting whole topic of myopia control.
Thanks so much for having me on. This is a pleasure.
Class is ended for today, and we have no exams or grades approaching. Please email me at foureyedprofessor@gmail.com if there are topics that you would like to hear and see through a professor's eyes.